You're listening to New Retirement Radio, brought to you by the team at Prout Financial Design.
Hello, I'm your host, Certified Financial Planner Dennis Prout.
I'm Heidi Cartwright, Financial Advisor and RICP.
Advisors associated with Prout Financial Design may be either 1. Registered representatives with and securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC, and investment advisor representatives of Integrated Partners, a registered investment advisor, or 2. Solely investment advisor representatives of Integrated Partners, a registered investment advisor and not affiliated with LPL Financial. Investment advice offered through Integrated Partners, a registered investment advisor. Integrated Partners and Prout Financial Design are separate entities from LPL Financial. Dennis Prout and Nathan Prout are solely investment advisor representatives of Integrated Partners and are not affiliated with LPL Financial. The opinions voiced in this show program are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriately qualified professional before making a decision.
WTCM News Talk 580, a good Thursday. It's time for New Retirement Radio with Prout Financial Design. Joining us today in the studio, as always, almost as always, Mr. Dennis Prout. Good morning, sir. Wait a minute. There we go.
It is great to be here. Thank you, Ron. On Thursday, 9/11/2025. The gravity of that date cannot be understated, and we are glad to be here. Thank you for listening, for those of you who are, and or to the rebroadcast, for those who have questions of a financial nature, if you would, Ron. And actually, today, I'm sorry, is not going to be a financial nature. We're going to be talking about 9/11. But if you would, Ron.
People could still call in with a question or a memory if they liked. 231 area codes, 947-0023 for calls or texts, 947-0023.
Joining us this morning, Beth Shire, our own Director of Marketing. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning, Dennis, and good morning to all of our listeners.
You bet. It's great to have you here, and joining us here this morning is Heather Cartwright, Heidi's sister. Heather has quite a history with 9/11, and as I was writing, somewhat to my embarrassment here, I'm just going to put it out there, 2 days ago, the email blast, I realized, oh my gosh, Thursday is 9/11. And Beth and I got talking, and in fact, I asked Heidi too, should we have your sister on? She said, well, yeah, I think so. So Heather Cartwright retired from as director of the Federal Crimes Victims Division of the Office for Victims of Crime, the Office of Justice Program, and Director Office of Justice for Victims of Overseas Terrorism, the National Security Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. Boy, quite a long intro there, but thank you, Heather, for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. And yes, it is a mouthful, all of those titles. But I'm retired. It's going to be 5 years in January.
Unreal. Mm. Amazing. So you had direct evidence, direct involvement, if you will, is a much better way to say this, with the 9/11 attacks as you were in Washington, D.C. at the time of those attacks, and the humanity of those who rescued, gathered, and ministered around those. You saw direct evidence of those who were injured and all the rest as you were directly involved, but you were also directly, possibly thinking within your own office that you might well be under attack. So as we were reviewing the show beforehand here, I said to Beth after we were done, this is an amazing story. Mm-hmm. And I want to do the very best job I can in relaying the power of this story that you have shared with us. It's incredible what it is you were trying to accomplish and what it is you were faced with as a part of this. So if you would introduce yourself, your history. Now, your history, your family history, goes all the way back to Parm Gilbert, who was a judge for the was a district judge here in Traverse City.
That's right. He was back in the early 1900s.
So an amazing history. And you said, as we were relating that, you were you found it quite interesting, but also motivating. For what it is that he was trying to do, or trying to do as a lawyer, and that carried over to you as well. If you would speak to that.
Well, I really think that he was an inspiration to me growing up when I was thinking about what career I would like to do, and he was kind of a legend in our family because he was a local Traverse City person, and the land that we went to every summer for vacation on Long Lake was inherited from him. So that was his legacy, one of his legacies to us. So he was always an inspiring kind of figure, and I decided I wanted to be a lawyer. I'm sure that played some part of a role in it, but also I enjoyed reading and logic and arguments, and so
that whole career drew you in.
It did.
All
it
right,
did.
And given your basic want to learn, but also to the constructive argument.
Yes, and also to do something to contribute to help people. And I think my my thought as a high school and college student thinking about going to law school was I wanted to use my gifts to help other people through difficult things. And that was really kind of a vague goal that I had. But I was able to, through being a lawyer, first I was a prosecutor in the District of Columbia, the U.S. Attorney's Office, for many years. And I found that working with the victims was really what spoke to me about what I wanted to do, to help people get accountability when something horrible had happened to them, and to walk with them through that time. So I did that as a prosecutor, but at some point it was just the timing of the victims' rights movement in this country where crime victims were getting more rights. Congress passed some laws, and the Justice Department needed experts to understand the new laws and to make sure the department complied with what was required to give to crime victims. And both rights, as in legal rights to get information, but also the support services that they need to cope with what had happened to them and to try to go forward and heal from the crime that had happened.
So much of this was overseas.
Ultimately, actually after the 9/11 attacks, my career really changed to focus more on terrorism, and Congress created a new office called the Office of Justice for Victims of Overseas Terrorism. That's one of those big titles.
Yeah.
And I was the second director and really helped to establish that office. And that was involved with terrorist crimes against U.S. citizens in foreign countries. So I did a lot of international work then.
All right. So let's go back to 9/11. So you're at the Department of Justice. Start us with your position there and your responsibilities within the department, if you would.
Sure. So in the Justice Department, there is the Office of Justice Programs you mentioned, and a subunit of that is the Office for Victims of Crime. And this is an office that administers the Crime Victims Fund. This is money that's not taxpayer money. It's money that comes from fines that criminal defendants in federal cases pay, including like antitrust cases and big amounts of money. And that money is used to support crime victims in the United States.
What a
all
great
different
idea.
Types of programs.
Oh
like,
my gosh.
You know, crime victim compensation to help people with medical expenses, funeral and burial costs, counseling programs like homicide support groups, and all sorts of programs. And that's what this money goes for. So I was working in that office, and I was director of the federal division, which is for federal crimes. Terrorism is a federal crime. Mm-hmm. So on 9/11, when this happened, it was my unit that was directly responsible for responding to this terrorist attack.
Now, where was your office in relation to in Washington, D.C.? Tell us about that.
Okay, so we were located at 810 7th Street. And as you know, the White House is at 16th Street.
Right. So what's the address, just for our listeners? What is the address of the White House?
1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
1600 Pennsylvania. So you're on 7th Street, you
so
said.
So that's about nine blocks.
Nine blocks away.
Nine blocks away.
Okay. And compared to the Pentagon itself?
The Pentagon is across the Potomac River, but it's really pretty close. You can see the Pentagon from the upper level of buildings in Washington.
Okay. All right. So you're right in the circle.
Yes.
Of responsibility.
Well, and then Congress, the Capitol building is at kind of zero. So, and I was at 7th Street. So we're about seven blocks west of the Capitol, but up a little bit too, a little bit north.
Okay. So then, take us to the 9/11 timeline, if you will. Okay. What was going on that morning as you drove in?
Well, for me, I lived in Alexandria, Virginia, so I drove over the 14th Street Bridge, and I went right by the Pentagon. It was the most beautiful day, unlike this morning. As I was driving here this morning, I thought, wow, 24 years ago, 9/11, it was not like this. It was beautiful. The sun was shining, blue skies. And I got in my office. My boss came in and said, hey, a plane has hit one of the World Trade Towers in New York. And I'm thinking, oh, maybe a little Cessna or someone who got lost or something, some accident. And she said, why don't you come in my office? And it's on TV. And we went in and we watched cable news. And as we were watching, we saw the second plane hit the second tower. Immediately after that, got the first phone call, which was from the NTSB. National Transportation Safety Board, their victim director, who said, this is yours. This is not an accident. These are not accidents. This is a deliberate attack.
So they already knew at that point that it was a deliberate attack.
Once the second plane went in.
Okay.
I think that most people logically would be, oh, this can't be an accident.
Yeah, this has got to be intentional. So who was that that contacted you from the NTSB?
Sharon Bryson.
Sharon Bryson.
Who was head of the victim programs at the National Transportation Safety Board. And pretty quickly after that, we got a call from the Attorney General, who was John Ashcroft, who said, we are going to have thousands of casualties. We need a plan. We need to get up on the news waves. We need a 1-800 number. So he called, and so right away, we were right in the thick of it.
So he knew that thousands of people were going to be dead as a result of these attacks.
Yes.
And before either of the buildings fell down.
Right.
That just sends a chill.
Yeah. Well, and to tell you a little bit about the timeline, to try to give you a sense of what it felt like to be there on that day, all of this happened very, very quickly. It's about a two-hour time lapse between the time that the first plane hit, which was, 8:46 a.m.
8:46, Flight 11 crashes into floors 93 through 99 of the North Tower.
Right. And that's the first that I knew that anything was wrong. So between that and the time that the North Tower collapsed, which was the second tower to collapse, that was 10:28. So really, it's almost less than around two hours.
Yeah. 8:46 to 10:28.
Yes.
Now, what's interesting is that Flight 11 took off at 7:59 from Boston for L.A. Flight 175 took off from Boston for L.A. As well at 8:15. At 8:19, Flight 11 crew members alert ground personnel that a hijacking is underway. So, and then at 8:20, American, so this is already starting to go on within the airwaves, and people are starting to figure this out, apparently.
Right. At some places, in fact, I don't know if the NTSB maybe already knew that there were hijackings. I don't know. That's other people's story about what they knew when. And there are movies on that and documentaries on that, and you can trace that time frame of what happened. The hijacker started as early as 5:45 in the morning going through security in the different airports. So,
now, at one point, you were also contacted by someone within the NTSB who had a relationship with one of the pilots or one of the airports or something.
Okay. Yes. So, yes, I can talk about that. That what actually happened is as we were when we first heard from the Attorney General that this was ours, that we were going to be looked to for response, we kind of took a moment, took a deep breath, because it was just hard to believe. You go from a normal average day to we are under attack in, you know, seconds.
Under high alert.
Yeah, high alert. And so we look at each other, and then we just jumped in and started doing work. What do we need? We need to get a 1-800 number up. We need to start getting lists of who's missing. And, you know, just right away jumping into that. And somewhere at that point, our office manager ran down the hallway of the building, of our floor, which was the top floor of our building, yelling, "There's another plane, there's another plane." Oh, her husband worked at Andrews Air Force Base, I believe, and they were scrambling jets to go shoot down flight, what is it, 175, I think, the one that crashed in Pennsylvania.
93.
Flight
93. Yeah.
Okay, sorry about that. That's right, flight 93. So she was running down the hallway saying, there's another plane, and it's headed for us. And we got no official notification of that. And then at that point, it turns from we need to respond to something going on in New York to a real fear that, okay, we're in the center, we're a target. I think that might have happened after the Pentagon was hit, though, and we did know the Pentagon was hit. So as the time is going by, the first flight crashing into a building was at 8:46. At 9:03, the second plane hits, and that's flight 175 that hit the South Tower.
Yes.
And then at 9:37, so just think how fast these things are happening. At 9:37 is when flight 77 crashed into the Pentagon. So when that happened, we knew pretty quickly, it was on the television, and we could see the smoke coming up. We were on the top floor of our building. We could see over to Virginia, across the Potomac, and we saw all the smoke coming up from the Pentagon.
Wow.
So after that is then when...
Oh, hang on a second. Yep. Ryan, you've got a report from
my goodness.
That time.
Oh, my goodness. We're looking at a live picture from Washington, and there is smoke pouring out of the Pentagon. It would appear that there has been another major explosion, this one in the nation's capital. You are looking at a scene of... apparent blast aftermath. There is smoke in the air over the Pentagon. We don't know whether this is the result of a bomb or whether it is yet another aircraft that has targeted a symbol of the United States power, but there is smoke pouring out of the Pentagon. This is coming at 9:43 Eastern Time.
That's Bryant Gumbel
Gumbel
from the Today Show. Yeah.
You bet. Oh, that's incredible. So... you saw this in real time.
Right. So once our office manager told us there was another plane, we then had to quickly switch, and that was probably one of the more difficult times. As managers, we have a staff on that floor. What do? We had been working terrorism cases, among other cases, but we had been working the East Africa Embassy bombing in particular, where a lot of people were killed and injured by flying glass. And we were at the top floor of our building with glass walls. And as I mentioned earlier, we were close to both the Capitol building and the White House, probably equidistant between them. So we started going into mode of protecting ourselves and our staff and trying to figure out what to do. In the meanwhile, there were all sorts of reports coming out that there was a bomb at the State Department, that there was a bomb on the mall, there was fires on the mall. And that there was smoke coming out of the metro system. So you don't know what's true and what's not true at that point. So What we did is we took our staff and we relocated to interior conference room on a lower floor in our building and got set up all our computers, our telephones, everything rerouted down there. So we went through that effort so that we could stay protected. At some point, we did find out about the Pennsylvania plane, too. Let's see when that happened. That happened at 10:03 a.m., Flight 93.
Crashed near Shanksville,
Pennsylvania. Yep. But then you don't know if there were other flights. I mean, we were getting feeds from the FBI, the Special Operations Center at the FBI, that there were more planes unaccounted for because, of course, the FAA had ordered all planes to land immediately in the United States. So as we went through, we were finding out, okay, you know, we're sure that those, because they didn't know how many had been hijacked. We didn't know if there were more planes coming.
Do you remember that day in Traverse City, Dennis or Beth, if you were here, Cherry Capital Airport, there were planes dropping out of the sky to land here. Whoever was nearby got the order, and they all landed
they
in Cherry
were down.
Capital.
Yeah.
There were dozens of commercial airliners. There.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I remember hearing at one point there were 200 flights that still hadn't landed at some point and that we were hearing from the FBI. So we were really on alert. So I think I'm kind of a witness to not only the response, but also what it felt like to feel like you were in the target zone there.
In the middle of everything.
And we had a big screen with the TV on it. And that's where I think one of the first victims of 9/11 was identified, who was Barbara Brasher Olson, who was a colleague of mine in the U.S. Attorney's Office. Mm-hmm. She was a fellow prosecutor. Her office was down the hall from me. And her picture flashed up on the screen, and that's when it really hit me. It said that she was on that plane.
Hmm.
And so there was kind of a personal connection there to one of the victims. After that, we found out both towers collapsed, and we just jumped in. I worked well into the night getting everything in place for the victim response. And
so the everything in place, what does that mean? Obviously, then you'd had experience in doing this. You just relied on all of the things that you had to put in place in terms of, I'm sure there were list on list on list of things that you needed to think about for those who were victims.
Well, an attack of this scope was unprecedented. And so I had worked after the fact on the Oklahoma City bombing case when it went to trial, and I'd worked on Pan Am 103 over Lockerbie. I'd worked on that case for years, and the East Africa Embassy bombings. So we had some sense of what was needed, but I'd never been a crisis responder, and this was the crisis phase. So we knew what needed to be put into place, and we jumped into place. And really, there were a lot of responders. I mean, New York City, the state of New York, really led the response in New York City. In Pennsylvania, it was the governor and the county officials in Pennsylvania. And the Pentagon was the military, and they are used to having crises and responding, and they have a very good victim assistance program. So we had a lot of the funding, though, that people needed. So we were key involved there because we had access to the Crime Victims Fund. And after the Oklahoma City bombing, there was a special fund put aside for terrorism cases that Congress had given us.
So this was put in direct use?
Yes.
That fund itself?
Yes.
For these folks?
Right, immediately. So we were putting programs in place. And the first thing we did was set up a 1-800 number so that people could call in if a family member or friend was missing, so we could start to get the list together. That's the key thing with any big crisis that happens where people are killed and injured. We need to get the list so that family members can be notified. And so that was our main goal that day, was putting a 1-800 number up so that people could start calling in because they were concerned that their family member might be a victim.
Okay. So you served as a direct point of contact for people so that they could get information, whether their family members were involved. How did you get that list? Where did that come from? Where did all that information come from?
We had very providentially set up a contract about 2 months before 9/11 with a call center. It was a company that did airplane crashes. So when there was an airplane crash and the airlines would put up a phone number for people to call in to find out about their family members, we put a contract into place so we could immediately engage them. And they had licensed, trained social workers to answer the phone. And once we put an 800 number in, then they took all the phone calls. And we also had to put in place a law enforcement aspect to that. So we needed FBI agents to be present in the call center, because if any information turned out to be evidentiary about the crime, we needed the FBI right there to know about it and be able to respond to it. So we coordinated putting that call center together that went up that night and was announced that night on television as the number you could call if someone in your family was missing. You know, particularly in New York, there were so many people in that building. There were people that escaped, and a lot of people didn't know if their family member might have been there, but if they hadn't heard from them, they were trying to find them. I don't know if you remember, but for weeks afterwards, there were pictures people up looking for family members.
Right. Yes. It went on and on.
We said today, remember the then mini morgues they brought into the world to Ground Zero, expecting to pull the rubble apart and find a lot of bodies, and they didn't find anything. You remember that?
Yes. In fact, they still are finding.
Yeah, they still are. DNA.
DNA identified remains of some of the people who died there. I know even this year I heard of maybe three more people who were identified.
Mm. Wow, because of the heat of the fire itself within and the amount of fuel that was in those planes.
Yes.
Wow.
So we jumped in and put that together.
Okay. What are some of the things that you think, how has it impacted how the government responds, given what's happened since, and reflecting back, obviously given it's 24 years now, what are some of the things that have been learned as a result of this within those departments, and what's different as a result of that?
Well, as far as victim assistance is concerned, one of the things we did that I've talked about before is the Family Assistance Center that was established at the Pentagon, and I did work there, and that's the way that it was a place that family members could go when they needed information, and they received briefings, they received a lot of support services there, counseling, financial support, things like that. That's a model that really came out of the Oklahoma City bombing and what the coroner did in Oklahoma City. But we instituted it at the Pentagon, and then also in New York City at several of the piers. They had a huge family assistance center downtown. So that's a model that's continued to be worked on and improved. But you'll hear after any mass crisis, certainly in this country and now overseas too, that the authorities will put together a family assistance center. I think they did that here in Traverse City after the Walmart attack.
I was going to ask, you said you're retired 5 years, but because that suspect in the Walmart stabbing in Traverse City is terrorism charges are filed, which would be a federal crime, I think, will there be victims assistance funding, do you know, from the office where you worked for the local people because of that federal charge?
You know, I'm not sure whether that there could be state terrorism charges too. I'm not sure. I'm not knowledgeable enough about that case to know what the charges are. But the funding source is available through the state governments too. There are grants that go out, formula grants that go out from the Justice Department to states and to support crime victim programs. So I do think that some of that money probably is going to support those victims.
Now, what's different within the FBI itself and the CIA, given what's happened and what did happen, and to help prevent that from happening again in the future?
Well, there were a lot of lessons learned. There was the 9/11 Commission, which the victims pushed for, which really examined, could we have prevented this? What happened? There's a good movie called The Looming Tower, and it's a book that talks about, you can see really what was going on in their investigation of Al-Qaeda network. And one thing you'll see is that there was a lack of communication between the intelligence community, which was watching this foreign terrorist organization and the law enforcement community that had the ability to act and maybe try to prevent. And because some of that information didn't get through, you know, there's a thought that could we have prevented it? But
sure.
We learned a lesson that those two entities needed to speak to each other. So out
so
of
the
that,
FBI and the CIA.
Yes. And those two functions really, like intelligence community, which is bigger than just the CIA. There's other intelligence agencies. And law enforcement that's bigger than the FBI. It's you're also your state and locals and your other federal agencies that could be involved. One thing that really directly affected me was the creation of the National Security Division in the Justice Department, which is the place where you brought together the intelligence community and law enforcement. So we could use the intelligence that we were getting to prevent attacks. And you saw that with the Zazi case, which is public now, mm-hmm. Which was an attempt by Mr. Zazi. He built these bombs in Colorado, drove across the United States, and was getting ready, putting them in backpacks for an attack on the New York subways. But the FBI was aware of this, so we had the intelligence ahead of time to know this was happening, and they were able to prevent it.
Wow, so they were able to stop that from happening because they had communication between the various divisions there.
Yes.
Between the FBI
those
CIA
functions
and those
in the government.
Okay.
Right. So that's one of the things that's changed.
Great. Is there a phone call here?
Yep, we'll get Joe and Cal Kaskas on the line here on Prout Financial Design's New Retirement Radio. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. I just wanted to start by saying thank you so much to Heather for her memories of this, and I think it's so important that we do reflect on that dreadful day. I was able to go to a 9/11 ceremony this morning, and other than the guard unit, the fire department, and the sheriff, I think there may have been about eight mm-hmm. civilians there. But I was a young lieutenant at Coast Guard headquarters in Washington, D.C. on that day, and I just wanted to share a couple of my memories. One was when there was a report that there was a private plane or something like that that might have still been in the air. They launched a couple of fighter jets out of Andrews, and they went supersonic over top of nice. Washington, D.C., which created another boom. And I remember the screams and the yells going through the office there. And I got dressed down a little bit that day because as we were watching the smoke from the Pentagon from our window on the sixth floor. And the captain had a meeting, and I said, "Captain, I think one of the best things we could do is get everybody out of this building and out of D.C. because it's going to be filled with so many emergency vehicles trying to help people. If we could just get out of the way." And he didn't like that very much. He thought that I was trying to cut and run, even though all we had was rubber bands and paper clips. I'm not sure what we would have done. Just a small redemption about 20 minutes later, that in fact was the order, was to evacuate and leave D.C. So, again, thank you. Thank you so much for your memories today.
Joe, thank you for your call. That's so appreciated, and your own perspective as well.
Yeah. Joe, did you say to your commander there, "I told you so"?
I did not do that.
Right. All right. Hey. Thanks awesome. For listening in Kalkaska and for the call today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Can you share a story on how ongoing support has changed someone's life or family? Something that you'd like to share, a personal story?
Well, actually, you know what I would like to do is talk about the victim community.
Related to it.
Okay. The 9/11 families.
Sure.
Because they are still ongoing with their support. And one of the organizations called Voices of 9/11 is now called Voices Center for Resilience, established by Mary Fetchett, whose son Brad was in one of the towers and was killed. And this is the letter they sent out to the 9/11 families yesterday, which I was able to receive also. Dear families and friends, tomorrow we mark the solemn occasion of the 24th anniversary. As we gather, we remember the 2,977 precious lives lost on September 11th, 2001, and the over 8,500 responders and survivors who have died since of 9/11-related illnesses. So that's 8,500 who have died since from 9/11-related illnesses, and a lot of that is from the dust that came up, a lot of cancers and other respiratory diseases. We also acknowledge the more than 90,000 individuals who are currently in treatment for serious medical and mental health conditions. So that's where those waves go out to the family members, people who are in the building and were able to escape in the buildings, several different buildings, but that's the scope of ongoing still support for them. And that's the Voices Center for Resilience. There's also an organization called Tuesday's Children, or Tuesday's Child, Tuesday's Children, I think, in New York City, which specifically focuses on children who lost parents in 9/11. And they have all sorts of programs, summer camps, and different ways of bringing the kids together so that they can talk to each other and give peer support. And they continue to be a very strong organization. And there are other 9/11 organizations. Those are two of which that I've worked most closely with. So there's a conference that Voices puts on every year in New York City on September 9th and 10th, the 2 days before the anniversary. And one day is dedicated to law enforcement and responding to terrorism and mass violence. I was invited 3 years ago to go, and I moderated a panel on leadership in the aftermath of an attack or a mass violence incident. Had several speakers on that panel. Kevin McHale, who was the sheriff of Las Vegas. He is now, and he was at the time of the Harvest shootings. Dan Stebbins, who was the head of Connecticut State Police when the Sandy Hook shootings happened, and Dean Hayden, who was a British counterterrorism expert who responded to the attacks on their subway. So that effort continues to train people to understand the effect of trauma on the first responders, which has been, really documented now and is an ongoing need to support the people that respond to these. So that effort continues to support the victims and to do things better and learn our lessons.
Great. I appreciate it very much, Heather. So in reflecting on that, it sounds to me, it's obvious that it's still having an impact on you recollecting all of this, not only on your career and mid part of your career, but still now. Do you ever have a sense that you want to write about any of these experiences personally? A question out of left field.
Well, yes, actually, I have. There's been some discussion with some of the people that I worked with on that day whether we should write a book about it, but nothing firm at this point. But we have talked about putting something together. There is, I also worked on the Pan Am 103 case, and I know that there is a documentary that's coming out this fall about that, and it's some of the same people who worked on 9/11 to show the victim angle of it.
Believe that. Now, The Looming Tower is what you recommended as a movie people ought to watch. That was kind of a documentary? Or just a movie itself about...
It's a movie itself. It's based on a book called The Looming Tower. By Lawrence Wright, which it really recounts what was going on in the investigation of Al-Qaeda and how close we were to discovering the conspiracy, the 9/11 conspiracy, before it happened. But it highlights some of the problems between knowing what's going on and actually acting and being able to prevent it.
So Bin Laden's involvement in that was suspected before the attack, and there were people who were following evidence to possibly indicate that they might try to do something over here, And one of those, you had related some of the possible things that they might do, and one of those was an attack with a plane into a building.
I think after there was the USS Cole attack,
yes,
which happened in Yemen, in the port there, where Al-Qaeda had these little small boats that they rammed into one of our ships, and it killed a number of soldiers and sailors who were on that ship. This ramming idea came up, so I don't think anyone anticipated the scope of 9/11 from where I sat. It was a complete shock that someone would do something like that, to use commercial airlines as bombs to run them into buildings where thousands and thousands of people were. So that was not anticipated. We did the best we could when we found out about it and just used our fundamentals of what is going to be needed for the immediate crisis and down the road for criminal justice. There was one person tried in the United States for the 9/11 conspiracy. That's Zacharias Moussaoui. Mm-hmm. Was someone who was on part of the conspiracy, but was chosen not to be one of the hijackers, but maybe was thought of maybe going to be a hijacker. And very close we came to finding out about the conspiracy through him. He went on trial in the federal court in Alexandria.
So there's several still in Guantanamo.
That's
being
right.
Held who were directly involved in the planning of the attacks.
Yes, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of the attack, is in Guantanamo, and several other hijackers, and they are in the military, the military justice system, and it's still ongoing. There have been a lot of setbacks. I don't know if you remember last year there was a talk of having a plea bargain to take the death penalty off the table, and that was countermanded by the Secretary of Defense. But coming out of the military commissions system, they had were thinking of trying to do a plea bargain.
Okay. So some kind of resolution to bring these people to justice. Hopefully so will happen sooner rather than later.
They say Khalid Sheikh Mohammed brought the idea to Osama bin Laden in 1996. Imagine, though, I mean, as horrific as it is, they were under the radar and they planned out this huge operation. I mean, incredibly got away with it. But a lot of planning went into that. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
So a lot of the things that are instituted now in terms of communicating to help prevent those attacks have been enforced as a result of 9/11. And hopefully they can continue to intercept any of these kinds of intents upon our nation.
Yeah, well, it's important not to take our eye off of this area.
Absolutely.
Though, because we do
absolutely
have enemies.
A continuing war. Heather Cartwright, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your time and efforts today with us. You made the day for us all. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I do this in my continuing the mission of supporting the victims and the heroic actions of so many Americans that took place that day.
Thank you.
All right, that'll do it for a special edition of Prout Financial Design's New Retirement Radio. Thank you, Dennis Prout and Beth Shire at proutfinancialdesign.com, and special guest Heather Cartwright. Thank you, Heather.